Thanks. This is work that is about to go to press, primarily done with Kat Deck at Caltech, who hopefully will come visit this workshop at some point. I'll also be talking a lot about prior papers written with the Kepler team. Many of the co-authors are in this room. Also a recent paper with the Planet Hunters team, headquartered at Yale, but based on the efforts of lots of amateurs looking through Kepler data. The question has come up throughout this conference, and already in this last question session, can we trust transit timing variation masses? The two questions I'm hoping to address in this talk are how are transit times converted into masses, and Dan has already discussed that in some detail. How reliable are the transit timing variation masses? Dan again has already tried to address this a bit. Unfortunately, he's introduced a lot of the terminology, but just a quick glossary for the non-experts. Conjunctions are the time at which the planets have their closest approach. The time between two conjunctions of two planets is referred to as the synodic period. He introduced the chopping signal, which is an alternating early and late transit times. I think Dan actually might have invented that term. The title of this talk, Measuring Planet Masses with Synodic Chopping, refers to looking at short timescale transit timing variations that happen on the timescale between the conjunctions of the planets. The chopping is just the alternating signal that you see typically. Okay, Dan also introduced how we get the general approach of getting masses and radii from transiting planets. I'm just going to review this again. The time between transits, or the average time, gives us, oops, let me make this a little bigger, gives us the orbital period of planets. The orbital period is important because we can then convert that into a semi-major axis, and from that, calculate perturbation theory based on the semi-major axis ratios of two planets that are transiting. And of course, if you have multiple planets, then you need the ratios between all those planets. So Kepler's law is good because for transiting planets, because we can get the periods very precisely, and therefore get the period ratios and semi-major axis ratios very precisely. The mass that we measure is always the mass of the perturbing planet, and it's actually the ratio of that mass to the mass of the star. So Newton's laws say that we're being accelerated by everything else in the universe. Now, in resonance, this does change slightly, and there are nonlinear effects that can give you the mass of the transiting planet, but those are typically very small effects that are harder to measure. There's one case, I think, there's maybe one or two examples in the Kepler data where we can measure the mass of the transiting planet from those very small variations when we have very high signal to noise. But it, generally, though, it's the mass of the other planets that are determining that are determined by the transit times of a given planet, and Dan demonstrated that nicely with the solar system example. Transit timing variation measurements of masses work the best when you can detect transits of both planets, because then you know the frequency of the perturbing planet's orbit, and so then it makes it much less probable that another planet, say at larger distances, which is what Lauren and Ruth pointed out, could cause a variation of that frequency. So when you know the frequencies of the planets involved, then you can actually just do a frequency analysis of the transit timing variations, and that gives you much higher confidence of which planet is causing that TTV signal. And then the other really important point is that because a transiting planet passes in front of the star every orbital period, and because transit time variations are generally small, a very small fraction of the orbital period, then you're sampling the orbital variations of the transiting planet on that planet's orbital frequency. And so there's very severe aliasing. You have basically no information at the frequency of the transiting planet. This leads to an actually infinite degeneracy, because you can take any integer multiple of the transiting planet's frequency and calculate a perturbation at that frequency difference with the orbital period of the perturbing planet, and that gives you a signal which is going to be combined together with all the other frequencies that are different integer multiples of the transiting planet's period, or transiting planet's frequency. And so that degeneracy can lead to some problems in analyzing TTVs, and in particular, it leads to a degeneracy between eccentricity and mass. But fortunately, the chopping signal is one way to break that degeneracy. Okay, and then of course to get densities of planets, we need the radius of the planet, but the transit depth scales as the radius ratio of the planet to the star squared. And so we can measure that generally very precisely. So the final step is to get the mass and radius of the star. Transit timing gives us the mass ratio. Transit depth gives us the radius ratio. And so with the properties of the star, we can get the properties of the transiting planet to high precision, in particular its density, which tells us about the interior composition. Now, transit timing variations can present a problem when you have a very small planet that is perturbed very strongly by another planet. And so what the Kepler pipeline has done is to take data over the length of the mission and fold it on a range of different periods, and at every phase look to see if there are dips in the light curve that may not be statistically significant individually, but when added up become more significant. So if a planet's being perturbed strongly by another planet, then the transit time variations can become larger than the duration of the transit. And so when you spread out that signal, when you fold it, you'll no longer get a high signal to noise. So this shows an example of a simulated near 2-to-1 planet system, 10-to-1 mass ratio, so it's a super Earth and a gas giant. And I've just taken the simulated light curve, added strong white noise, folded it, and it's very difficult to see any transit by eye. Now, if you bend this up, you might be able to make a detection. Then I've taken these same data and aligned all the times of transit of these planets. I've corrected for the dynamical offsets. And then when I just fold it without bending or anything, immediately the transit becomes apparent. And so it's clear that transit timing variations can lead to a bias in some cases, where it may be hard to detect a very small, and in some cases very dense planet, because denser planets are smaller, so they present a smaller transit signal. So this is the quasi-periodic planet problem. Several years ago, Josh Carter and I were discussing this, and I turned to the best problem-solving tool that we have at our fingertips, which is Google, and I queried quasi-periodic pulse detection, because a transit looks like an inverted pulse. And out popped this. This is the first search result that turned up, was this paper by Kalmanov and Jian. And they presented a very fast, efficient way to find pulses in a time series in which the time between pulses was constrained to be within some time range. In this case, they assumed a uniform time sampling, which is almost perfect for Kepler. Kepler has some data gaps, but they keep the cadence uniform. And then you can also, so that's really all you need to specify, and then it goes through, you specify the duration of the pulse, the depth of the pulse if you want. You can actually marginalize over the depth and derive the depth, and it goes through your data set and finds all these pulses for you. So it's perfect, actually, for Kepler data. And so Josh proceeded, as Josh is really good at doing, farming out a lot of processes to a lot of computers at CFA, and searched through the Kepler objects of interest at the time, several years ago, looking for other planets in these systems that might be strongly perturbed. Note that in the abstract of this paper, they did not mention transit times, but they did, They did mention electronic warfare, though, which is a little bit worrying. Yeah, it's the first thing to mention, actually, yeah. So maybe it's clear where they got their funding from. Yeah, exactly. The other thing is that you do need to specify the period of the transit, that this technique searches through in phase, but then you can just do a periodogram search varying the periods to cover all possibilities. Okay, so the first discovery that came out of this was in this system. This is a Kepler object of interest for which there were 55 transits at the time of publication. And there are so many transits that the plot that Dan showed, in which there are little blips that were moving in time, was really hard to see. So instead, I plotted it as an intensity where blue is deeper and green is brighter. So this is just the intensity of the star. Each row is a transit of the planet. This has been folded on a periodic ephemeris. And so if there were no transit timing variations, this would have been a straight line. This was a planet found by the Kepler pipeline, and you can see why. Each transit is very deep and very high signal to noise.
What's the point of the red?
The red is our best fit model, and it's the time of ingress, so when the transit starts, to the time of egress. And so time goes this way. This time is in hours, but the period of this planet is 16.7 days, so each of these rows is 16.7 days apart. The gray is just missing data. And so you can see that this planet is not orbiting periodically. We've seen plots of transit time variations, but this is the actual data set. And you can see, actually, it makes these sudden jumps, and some of them are quite dramatic, which means it's suddenly changing its orbital period. In fact, you can count these jumps, and there's six orbits between two successive jumps. Okay, so Josh applied this quasi-periodic technique after removing this planet, applied it to the rest of the data set, and magically, he did this to a lot of KOIs, but this is the one where something popped out that had been missed by the Kepler pipeline, which is the planet on the left. This shows another river plot. It has 65 odd transits, and each transit, you can see, is barely detected. This is more like a marsh than a river, where the noise is such, this has been rescaled, but the noise is such that you would not, for any of these rows, be confident that there's a transit going on. And because when you fold it on a periodic ephemeris, this is at 13.8 days, these transits don't align, then you're not going to build up signal to noise with time. But this quasi-periodic detection method was able to follow the river or the marsh and detect that planet, each transit at something like 2 sigma. But when you fold them all together and align these, you get a 22 sigma detection of this planet, which is known as Kepler 36b, and which has been shown in David's talk and other talks, which has the most precisely measured mass for a super Earth-sized transiting planet. And you'll note that the jumps that you saw in this planet match up with jumps in this planet. And so what's going on is that the planet period ratio of these two planets is close to 6 to 7. So every 6 orbits of this planet and 7 orbits of this planet, they pass one another. And because the period ratio is 6 to 7, these planets are extremely close to one another. Gravity is 1/r², so they have a strong perturbation at conjunction. They suddenly change their orbital eccentricity, suddenly change the period, which is why you get a change in the direction. And so it's at those kicks, the kicks of those conjunctions, that gives us very, very strong constraints on the masses and the eccentricities of this planetary system. And so we've constructed photodynamical models, which Dan described, in which we compute the dynamics and then fit each transit. And so this is the data set that we fit, and the models match perfectly. And that's what the red is denoting, is just the and start of ingress and end of egress, and it reproduces these jumps perfectly for both planets. And then again, the anti-correlation between the rivers of these two planets is due to conservation of energy. Kepler's law says that period scales with the semi-major axis, so the semi-major axis of one planet changes outwards, then the O1 has to change inwards in order to conserve energy. Okay, so if you take one of the dynamical models for this planet and plot the eccentricity times cosine of the longitude of pericenter, which has the unfortunate notation that it's omega, which physicists think of as a frequency, but dynamicists use this to denote the longitude at which the planet has the closest approach to the star in its orbit. So if you plot the E cosine omega versus E sine omega for the inner planet in red and the outer in blue, you get this nice spirograph plot. And what you can see here is that there are these knots, such as this one, where there's not much going on. This is actually, the planets spend most of the time in those little knots because that's when they're far apart in their orbits, away from conjunction, and they're not perturbing each other very strongly. And then you see these strong jumps, such as this one, which is happens during the conjunction when the planets pass close to one another, and so the eccentricities suddenly jump in value, and that's what causes that discontinuity at the next transit. And then as they pass one another, they spend a long time not being perturbed very strongly, and then you get another jump. And so you can see these planets are not exactly at a 6-to-7 period ratio, and so the great inequality for this is approximately 5 times the conjunction time scale. So you get 5 conjunctions to kind of come around these petals. And for and so that's what causes, I'm having problems here. So that's what causes this periodic variation. So each of those petals corresponds to one period of this river, and there's approximately 2 periods. There's a little more data now in the Kepler data. So let's see. Okay, so we can, so I can qualitatively reproduce this structure by just assuming a Keplerian orbit, which is the solid points on the right-hand side, and then as the planets pass one another, give them each of them a kick using Hill's approximation, which is just a local expansion in the distance, or it's a local expansion of the equations. So as the planets pass one another, they're close enough that you can calculate their perturbations analytically, and that's what's plotted here. And you know the analytic approximation doesn't take into account all the wiggles, but it does a pretty good job in qualitatively reproducing the structure of this plot. And you know, so if you were to observe this system a much longer time, then these you might get much better constraints because you go around this petal. Turns out this the position of these petals has a degeneracy, but that degeneracy is only partial, and we can actually get a very good constraint in the absolute value of these eccentricities. So from these photodynamical models, we ran long Markov chain analyses. Josh and I both did separate analyses, and we got consistent results. And so the little crosses you've been seeing in other plots are actually just a summary of a posterior distribution, which is shown in gray here from the Markov chain analysis. And the red curves show the 1 and 2 sigma confidence ellipses, where which contain that number of points in the posterior distribution of the Markov chain. And so as has been noted earlier in this conference, this one is consistent with an Earth-like composition, passes right through the center of the posterior distribution for this planet. While the larger planet is about 3.7 times the radius of the Earth, very similar in size to Neptune and Uranus, but half their mass, and so that's why it's called a mini-Neptune. It's about 8 Earth masses. So it's surprising that these are the two closest planets found to date, and yet they have very different densities. And Jonathan nicely explained that with this photo evaporation of the larger planet, a smaller planet, which has smaller escape velocity, and it was unable to retain its envelope. So I'm at University of Washington. This is a picture of the moon over Seattle. The outer planet in Kepler 36 is about the size of Neptune. And so if we pulled Neptune as close to Earth as those two planets are when they have their closest approach at conjunction, then instead of seeing the moon, we'd see something about 2.5 times bigger than the moon, and it might look something like Neptune. Yeah, different obliquity. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I didn't. We don't know the obliquity, unfortunately. So this is not the only planet that we found with the quasi-periodic detection technique. This shows another planet system, 34-day orbital period and 125-day orbital period. This is a Jupiter-sized body. This is a super Earth mini Neptune-sized body. They don't show much in the way of transit time variations, at least at the scale you can see on this plot. This one actually does have detectable transit time variations. I'll show it subsequently. These are close to a 4-to-1 period ratio, which makes you wonder, is there a planet in the center that Kepler missed? And we did detect another planet with the quasi-periodic detection technique in this system, but we got scooped by Planet Hunters, which is a great website which serves Kepler data to the public, and people can go through and look for blips in the data. Our first search at this system didn't handle stellar variability very well, and so we missed this planet initially. Later, when we improved our handling of their detrending, we did detect this, but it was detected beforehand by amateurs looking through Kepler data, which is really nice. This one has a 66-day orbital period, and you can see it has a huge variation in transit times, which is why a Kepler pipeline initially missed it. And then the red, again, is my best fit, basically a photodynamical model. And you can see that these are fairly significant. Each of these is very blue compared to the bluish-green noise around it. And so that's why amateurs were able to see the blips by eye in the light curve. Mm-hmm. Yeah, pipeline got both of these, which you can see have very straight river plots. When you fold them, they line up nicely, and you get high signal to noise in the folded. So this one has about 12 transits. Each one is really significantly detected, which is why you have this really nice green and blue color. This one, each transit is a little more marginal, but nevertheless, when they folded it, they got a very significant detection. Okay, so now we can measure the transit times of each of these transits and make the O minus C plot like Dan showed, and this shows those three planets. This has a Kepler number, but the Planet Hunters decided to call it Planet Hunters 3, the third planet system that they found. And so the three planets, the innermost planet has each of these panels has different scalings in time. They're all in minutes. Now you can see the middle panel has a few hundred minute variation in transit times. So that's why it was why it was initially missed by the Kepler pipeline. The Kepler pipeline later did find it in a very with much more data, and I think it had the wrong orbital period initially. It was trying to line up transits as best as possible. Okay, and then the error bars are plotted on these transit times, but they're very tiny. The outermost planet, which is a Jupiter-Saturn-sized planet, has transit timing variation amplitude, which is about at the 10-minute level. Now, what you see here, this period ratio of these two planets, the inner one doesn't show any detectable transit time variations, and now actually, it probably has a small enough mass that it does not perturb this one significantly. This is a large, giant planet, so it's perturbing this one most strongly. You see the anti-correlation in the transit times. The grade inequality, or TTV period, that Dan discussed matches what you would expect for the periods of these two planets, for the 1.9 period ratio, due to the 2-to-1 resonant term and the disturbing function. The other feature you can probably see, again, the error bars are plotted here, is the chopping signal of this planet, which is due to this outer planet. And that actually is on the synodic frequency, the time between conjunctions of these two planets. Because it's close to 1 to 1.9, then the difference in their frequencies is close to the frequency of this planet, and that's why you get that alternating pattern, because it's happening, every other transit of this planet is how long it takes this planet to go around the star approximately. But again, because of the grain inequality, that drifts with time, and so the phase of this chopping changes with time. So sometimes it's more apparent than others due to that effect. Okay, so how much time do I have left? 7 minutes? Okay, thanks. All right, so Dan alluded to, and I've also mentioned, that there's this degeneracy between mass and eccentricity, which was, I think, first pointed out by Lithwick et al. 2012. And so I'm showing kind of a version of their equations. They define this quantity delta, which is equal to the ratio of the periods of the two planets times the ratio of two integers that differ by one. And so if the planets were exactly, say, 2-to-1 period ratio, and if J was equal to 2, then that ratio would be 1. And then they subtracted off 1 to tell how far you are away from that particular resonant term, J to J minus 1. So if it were exactly on resonance, then delta would be 0. So delta is a measure of how far the planet system is from a resonance. This formula actually doesn't work in resonance. It has to be modified. But it works well when you're close to a resonance, because those resonant terms can still dominate the perturbations between the planets. Now, the properties of transit timing that I mentioned, you can see, and this is the transit timing variation equation for the inner planet. There's a similar equation for the outer one. So one for the inner planet. It scales with the period of that planet, and then the resonant term scales as 1 over delta. And so the closer you are to resonance, the larger this term becomes. And that's why you get that large resonant signal. And essentially happens because there's coherent kicks that add up over time over that great inequality period. It also scales as the mass ratio of the second planet to the star. But then the pesky thing, maybe not pesky, but is that there's this, I'm not writing out the full formula, but there's this order eccentricity term added to another factor of order unity. And the eccentricity term is divided by delta, the distance from resonance. So even if the eccentricities of the planets are small, because you're dividing by delta, this term can be large. And so there's a very strong dependence on eccentricity. It also depends on the orientation of the eccentricities. Longitude of periastron. And so this is what leads to the eccentricity mass degeneracy and transit time variations. This is occurring on this great inequality period, which in this case is J minus 1 over P1 minus J over P2. So for J equals 2 in this case, it gives you that the correct period of that long variation. Now, because of aliasing, the sinusoidal component, this is, you take the real part of this to get the transit timing variations, but the frequency of the transiting planet, because it's being sampled on that frequency, you can't actually measure this, because it's always going to be at the same phase when the planet transits as it comes around the star. And so you can, the origin of this degeneracy, actually, there's a little bit of a fudge in this formula, but it's due to different frequencies at the period of the transiting planet. Okay, so that degeneracy can be a problem when you're trying to measure masses of planets. So enter this synodic chopping signal, that little up and down signal, which is much smaller in amplitude, but nevertheless, it doesn't have the resonant term in its eccentricity dependence. So it just depends on eccentricity. So if the eccentricity is small, then you mainly get a dependence on the mass of the perturbing planet, plus an analytic function of the period ratio or the semi-major axis ratios of the planets. And then this occurs on the frequency that's a difference between the two frequencies of the orbital frequencies of the planets. Again, this term can't be measured, so there's other frequencies that can add to this, but this turns out to be the strongest term in the perturbation expansion. Okay, so what this means for the Planet Hunters 3 case is if I just measure the masses of the two planets with that large resonance signal, I get a very large correlated uncertainty in their masses, which is indicated by this light blue region. So this is the mass of the middle planet, the one that was initially missed. The perturbation of the transit time variations of the outer planet constrain its mass and eccentricity, and the eccentricity degeneracy leads to this banana-like confidence region at 1 sigma. The outermost planet, the Jupiter-sized planet, turns out its mass is constrained by that chopping of the middle planet that was found. And so this yellow region shows, by measuring the chopping amplitude, what the mass of that outer planet should be. And so if you combine the confidence, if you combine the resonant and the chopping signals, you get this red confidence region. And you can see it overlaps between the light blue and the yellow. If you do a full dynamical fit to the system, you get the blue confidence region. These are all 1 sigma. And so you can see this analytic approach gives you a very close approximation to a full dynamical fit to the system. Thanks. Okay, so now we can take these planets. This diagram, which I had for Kepler 36, only goes up to 20 Earth masses. That other planet was similar to Saturn, so it's way over here. It's off this diagram. But Planet Hunters 3C, the planet that was missed initially and found by the Planet Hunters, has about a 4 Earth mass plus or minus 0.9 Earth mass confidence ellipse, which is that red curve point there. And its radius is about 2.7 times the radius of the Earth. So this has to have, again, has to have a hydrogen, likely a hydrogen helium envelope surrounding a rocky core, or maybe some ices in there as well. Okay, so in conclusion, close planets can show sharp jumps at conjunction. Near resonant planets show large amplitude transit time variations, which in some cases can be degenerate between the eccentricity and the mass. There is a way to break this degeneracy with very high signals noise data, it turns out. But if you can also get high enough signals noise to measure the chopping of one planet, particularly it's usually the inner planet that's measurable for in the 2-to-1 case, then you can get an extra constraint in the planet's masses and break that degeneracy. This may be important for the test spacecraft, which will take shorter timescale observations of transiting planet systems. And because chopping occurs in the synodic timescale, which is shorter than the resonant timescale, this may be a way to get masses of planets with the test spacecraft. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Questions for Eric?
Can you bring back the slide with the marsh of Kepler 36b?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, that went wrong.
Yeah, right.
That's the other one.
Yeah, right. So there is an overlap in phase of all the transits, mm-hmm. right? So I wonder if even without the correction of the TTV, you wouldn't get just a smeared transit with much longer duration that you might be able to detect.
Yes, the Kepler pipeline was able to detect this with further data after we found it. Mm-hmm. Wow. Does that answer your question?
The question is why it was not detected before.
Initially, well, it's simply a matter of building up signal to noise. And, you know, in the initial Kepler data, if you just searched to this part, you could have used a periodic ephemeris and folded these. But due to their false alarm cutoff at 7 sigma or something, that wasn't enough. Now, eventually, though, even without taking into account the transit time variations, they were able to detect it because there's simply enough data that you can, even if you don't correct for that, the Kepler pipeline was able to detect it later on. So the quasi-periodic technique is kind of most valuable in sort of when you're just below the signal to noise, if you fold it without accounting for transit time variations. It's also valuable if you have really huge transit time variations, like Planet Hunter's 3 case, although in that case, each individual transit was detectable. But if that planet had been much smaller, then the you wouldn't be able to see those by eye.
And the jumps are, the period between the jumps, this is the synodic period, I think.
Yeah, so the period ratio of these is 6 to 7. So every, every seven, it's the synodic period. Every 7 transits of the inner planet and 6 transits of the outer planet is when you get the jump. And that's because they're close to 6 to 7. So that's the time between synodic, that's the synodic time, the time between conjunctions for these two planets.
So this is the chopping.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thanks for two very nice talks, which are all based on the prior that what you're seeing in your TTVs and O-C's comes from planets, okay? Now let me take another prior. Let's suppose that the stars, the host stars, have a weak magnetic field with some weak spots that mm-hmm. may or may not be coupled to the magnetosphere of the existing transiting planets.
Yeah.
Can you exclude that? Because it would also give you tiny radio velocity variations due to skewed profiles. And if part of that would be the cause of the variability, how would that impact on your masses that you deduce?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the question is about star spots. Well, Dan's actually done some work in this. One brief answer is that if the planet crosses a spot, that can throw off your transit time measurement. If you have good enough signal noise, you can see that spot and just avoid it in your analysis. If there are non-transited spots, those affect the overall flux, but they don't affect the time of the transit. There, you know, on long time scales, you can have actual variations in the size of the star due to magnetic effects, but those are probably really within the noise, very hard to measure. But Dan? Yeah.
Yes, in fact, we have seen spot crossing events in quite a lot of systems. First, with not with the confounding fact of extra planets, but with Kepler-30, which I showed briefly, there are really strong star spot crossings. So a joint analysis of TTVs with the star spots taken into account was done by Sanchez Ojeda.
One advantage of detecting planets with transits is that the transits are rather short compared to the orbital period. So this is, you know, 5 hours compared to the 16.7 days. And so it's a signal that's very hard to create with spots, because spots generally cause variations on the rotation period of the star. Now, you can have correlated noise due to granulation and other things, and that's a worry when the signal noise gets very low. And they're good ways to handle that, and a lot of those techniques have not yet been applied to the Kepler data, so that's actually there's some room for improvement. But we're not, it would be basically impossible to mimic this sort of signal with spots.
Sure.
Yeah, and Svi has a paper on that,
So, Eric, one thing that, of course, is striking and is, of course, very dynamically motivated is the symmetry of the two river plots here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm not familiar with this quasi-periodic pulse detection technique, but is there another set of possible hidden planets detectable simply by taking those planets which are easily detected, say, in the standard pipeline analysis? And using the phase variation to drive a reanalysis of the light curves to look for the hidden smaller planets in the system that may have escaped detection.
Yeah, so we've talked extensively about this in the Kepler TB group. So there's one issue: if you just have sinusoidal variation, such as this is much more common. So if you just see sinusoidal variation, let's say it didn't have chopping, it turns out that there's usually a discrete number of periods for a perturbing planet that if you don't know it's transiting, you don't know its period. So if a perturbing planet doesn't transit, there's a discrete degeneracy between different orbital periods and different resonances that would give you that same super period. So you could potentially narrow down your search by just searching at those discrete periods. And that may have an advantage of avoiding the false alarm probability that can come from searching through a whole range of different periods. So far, we haven't tried this, but it's definitely a good idea. Does that answer your question, or do you have something else in mind?
How essential was the short cadence data in getting some of these really tight characterizations? Because I often see short cadence data in these papers, though I know that might have been just because you might as well go out and get it when the Kepler mission was still running. But since you can't do that anymore, was it really essential?
So for Kepler 36, when we switched from long to short cadence, which happened after they realized that it was an interesting system, that there was a transiting planet, and so short cadence might be valuable, in particular for resolving the ingress and egress time scales. The long cadence Kepler data is 30 minutes, which is generally longer than a ingress or egress time, and so it blurs out the measurement of your timing, which is primarily coming from the sharp jump in flux that occurs at ingress and egress. So in the Kepler 36 case, we saw that error bars improved by about a factor of 2 in the transit timing measurements in going from long to short cadence. So that was very valuable. That gave us, you know, much, that gave a better signal to noise for the masses of those planets. Let's see. And then I think Planet Hunters 3 also had some short cadence data. I actually can't remember how much it had. Yeah, and then short cadence also gives you the opportunity to do astroseismology. In Kepler 36, that was crucial because the astroseismology of the star gives very precise stellar parameters. In particular, astroseismology usually gives you a very precise density of the star. And because transit timing gives you the mass ratio and the transit depth gives you the radius ratio, you get a really good density ratio of the planet to the star. So if you have the density of the star, then your error contours are actually going to have a slight curvature to them because they're going to be along density. So if the star has a well-measured density but not a well-measured absolute mass or radius, then sometimes there's a little bit of slope to some of these contours, which is, I think, partly due to that effect.
Last question. Eric, thanks. Yeah. Thanks for that great talk. There's another potential source of TTVs that may be of particular interest to some folks in the audience, and that are TTVs that could arise from the presence of a moon. Mm-hmm. Could you make some general comments about that?
Yeah, so this has been pointed out by Schneider and Sartoretti, I think, maybe been the first to point it out, and then David Kipping has written a series of papers on this idea of looking for moon perturbers to planets. And one interesting thing is that a moon strongly perturbs the velocity of the planet, and so you can measure variations in the durations of transits. If you can detect variations in the durations of the transits, that may be a way to detect a moon, in addition to the timing variation. It depends really how close the moon is to the planet. And the duration variations generally have a larger noise. They're measured with less precision than the average time of a transit. And it may bear looking into the noise a little bit better, but the long cadence really hurts you actually in trying to look for moons from timing variations and duration variations. And we have done a search for this, and David Kipping searched through quite a few stars, and there's no, every time I seen a transit timing variation that might be due to a moon, turns out it's due to another planet. I haven't done as thorough a search for duration variations, but Dan and others have, there's very few transiting planets in the Kepler data that show evidence for variations in the duration of transit. So it would be really cool to detect an exomoon with that technique, but I'm not too hopeful the Kepler data are of good enough quality to do that.
Okay, let's thank Eric again. There was some announcement for the break, and then you're all off for coffee.
Yes, before we peel take off, two announcements. If people are departing tomorrow and would like a ride either to the airport, the Amtrak station, or the airport or Airbus to LAX, you can sign up today so that they can make plans sort of right where you get your hats and register and all that stuff. So remember to do that if you can. And then right now, as people are filling this room, before you get your coffee, we're going to take a group photo. So we're waiting to find out where we go for the group photo. Obviously, it'll be outside. I'm not sure quite which side of the building.